Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
I asked the Prime Minister,
how good is Australia?
Please explain.
Mate, this is just impossible.
Too many people were confused.
You bet you are. You bet I am.
I have always believed in miracles.
That's not a policy.
Not now, not ever.
I mean...
These comments are completely inappropriate.
Oh, I'm sure she's right.
Yeah, but I ain't spending any time on it.
How pathetic.
You're a classic space invader.
Disgusting, mud-sucking creatures.
You should be ashamed of yourselves.
Oh, fair shake of the sauce bottle, mate.
Taste of democracy, very good.
Well, hello there, Mark Kenny here with a special democracy sausage extra, another serving midweek. I know that you're really happy about that. And with me, of course, as always, is Dr. Maria Teflaga from the School for Politics and International Relations at the ANU here. Welcome, Maria.
Greetings from the bubble.
From the bubble, indeed, on this side of the lake. And I'm really happy to welcome back to Democracy Sausage Professor Nicholas Biddle from the Centre for Social Research and Methods here at ANU. And Nick, you've just released some really fascinating research on exposure and the impacts of attitudes on attitudes of the 2019-20 Australian bushfires. And it's pretty snappy stuff, really, when you think about it. We're still in summer as we do this recording, and you've got this research out there. Take us through some of its key findings.
Yeah, so the interviews took place around the middle of January, so towards the tail end of the main bushfires. And what we did is we asked a little over 3,000 people about different forms of exposure. So we asked a couple of questions about more direct exposure, so whether you had property damage, whether your property was threatened, or whether you had to be evacuated. And we found a little over 14% or so of the population said that, yeah, they had some form of direct exposure.
That's not many, pretty significant.
Pretty high,
isn't it?
Yeah. And so, you know, when you do these surveys, you when you first get the data, you kind of think, well, does that kind of make sense? And it was high, so we did a little bit of background, and we had a look at the estimated number of residents in the area, the estimated number of visitors in the area, and lines up pretty well. And then we looked at some of the insurance claims, and not all insurance claims would have came through or been publicized yet, but it kind of lines up. And I guess what it shows is unlike, say, previous fires where very localized but very large effects on very local areas, the 2019-2020 bushfires were very widespread across Australia. And, you know, we had respondents from every state and territory who said that they were somehow affected. Now, some of those may have been because they were traveling outside of those states and territories. But yeah, very, very large, very diverse exposure. But we also thought it was quite important to ask about more indirect forms of exposure for a couple of reasons. One is to get as complete a picture as possible of what happened over the summer, but also because our reading of the literature suggests that more indirect exposures can have, if not larger, but as large an effect as the more direct forms. And that was even larger. So we asked about whether you knew someone who had property threatened or property damaged, whether you had to change your holiday plans or travel plans. And within the Canberra bubble, we all experienced it, whether you're physically affected by smoke.
The bubble was full of smoke.
The bubble was full of smoke, away. It was. And the bubble was trapping the smoke in. And
quite literally.
And we found more than half the population reported some form of physical effect from smoke. When we looked at Canberra, 9 in 10 Canberrans said that they were affected by the smoke. The other 1 in 10 were probably on holidays in New Zealand or something.
Yeah.
Like
well, they never went outside.
Yeah. And the final question we asked was just a general one about, I guess, fear and anxiety. And that kind of not knowing what's happening to your friends and family, not knowing whether you're town or suburb is kind of going to be next. And once again, we found a little over half of the population said that they felt some form of fear and anxiety or worry and anxiety over the summer. And then when you combine those forms of indirect exposure, more than three quarters of the population had some exposure to the bushfires.
That's really a very large number, isn't it? 77.8%.
So, and once again, when we looked at the data, was that too large? And then we kind of asked around ourselves, well, how would you answer these questions? Like, yeah, okay, I was affected by the smoke.
Yeah.
I knew people who had property damage.
Well, I would have answered yes to a number of those questions because if you lived in Canberra, as you say, you were affected by the smoke.
Yeah, and then you think, well, okay, well, the start of the fire season, north coast of New South Wales, Brisbane, southern Queensland was affected. Parts of the Blue Mountains, lots of smoke in parts of Sydney over the period. Melbourne had some days of quite high smoke, and then the kind of the east coast of Victoria as well. So kind of it really shows how ubiquitous that experience was of some form of exposure, either knowing someone, having to change what your not just kind of short-term plans, but the things which you do every year. You know, there's people in Canberra.
Well, Canberra go down the coast, right? You couldn't go down the coast.
Or people from Melbourne go kind of to the Pacific coast, or people in Sydney who travel up and down the coast. And that change, that uncertainty, I think, has not only had direct impacts on people, but also appears to have impacted on their views of a range of topics. One of the interesting questions was whether this was going to have an effect on people's attitudes towards environmental issues, and that was obviously part of the narrative. This was not a bushfire, which was where the discussion was just what are you doing in the local area, how's the state and territory responded. This was a bushfire crisis which had global impact, but also kind of national policy which was brought to the front. And we certainly found that people who were exposed in some way to the fires were more likely to say that the environment was kind of one of the main issues from their perspective. And also, I guess, more likely to attribute some of those changed views to the poor handling or this self-reported poor handling by the government. So it had not only effects on views on the environment, but also views on the government, views on Scott Morrison, as well as just a what we think is a pretty good catch-all term, which is, you know, how satisfied are you with the direction of the country, and how confident are you in kind of the policy environment, and all of those things were not only impacted at a national level, but impacted more so for those who reported some indirect or direct exposure.
It's interesting, Maria, isn't it? Because all those numbers really seem to back up the anecdotal suggestions around that there has been this shift in the community sentiment over perceptions of the government, perceptions of the adequacy of policy in the climate space and all those things. It all seems to be adding up to a significant kind of hinge point in our politics.
Yeah, I mean, I guess one of the things I really want to know, Nick, about the findings of the ANU poll is, you know, we know in voting behaviour, in the literature, median voter theorem, the economy is pretty much the primary driver of vote choice. You know, do you think that the results from your survey are likely to decay over time, or do you think that there is sort of information in there that this might be sort of creating a systemic change, as far as you can say from one poll?
At the risk of giving the standard researcher response, which is where you need more research.
Research?
Yeah, time will tell.
I think there's a couple of hints. So one is, to me, kind of confidence in the government is a slightly different measure and perhaps a more stable measure than who you're going to vote for, and the fact that there was quite large changes in not only kind of how likable the PM, but also is how confident you are in the PM. And my sense is that we know there's a downward trend in kind of confidence in institutions, with a little bit of variation around that trend, but that's harder to lose, but also harder to regain that confidence. I guess another thing which makes me think it's not just kind of that random fluctuation is that there were types of voters who are more likely to swing away from the government as observed in the poll. So one of the things we, not only in our ANU poll findings from the previous election, but other data from both the opposition and the government and other kind of analysis of the previous election was the swing towards the coalition from female voters, and that in many ways that swing was one of the things which got Morrison over the line in a very tight election. And what we found with our data is a very large swing in the opposite direction from female voters with this survey. So what
that suggests, can we drill down into that? Like, sure. I mean, you know, what are the demographics? So like, are these, you know, are these young women? Are these older women? Are these mums? Right?
Yeah. So that's we haven't kind of sliced and diced it that way. What we have looked at, though, is other predictors of kind of swing away from the coalition. And so one is a very young, relatively young, who were less likely to vote for the coalition in the first place, are even more less likely. So I guess a divergence, an increased segregation by age in voting patterns. Relatively advantaged people swung away from the coalition over the bushfires, but had swung towards the coalition in the previous election. But to me, the most interesting one was variation in kind of the capital, non-capital city. So what we found with the previous election is, even though there were kind of differences in levels, so different in voting patterns between capital and non-capital cities, there wasn't that much of a change. That was pretty consistent over the time leading up to the election. Whereas with our data from October compared to January, an even larger movement away from the coalition in non-capital cities, which was surprising to me, because we're already controlling for bushfire exposure in our analysis. So it's not just that those who live outside of capital cities are more exposed. It's that everyone in non-capital cities has moved away from the coalition over this period. Now, whether that stays or not is another question. And
it's, in a sense, it's the big question politically, I guess.
Yeah,
there'd be people in the coalition who'd be thinking, as the, you know, the kind of this whole crisis, this whole summer of crisis, kind of recedes in memory, then you know, perhaps some of these trends will soften. You know, perhaps people will stop being, it won't be such a vote changer as it might show up at the moment.
Yeah, and also, if I was leader of the opposition, I wouldn't be overly happy with these results either, because a lot of the swing went to other parties. And we know that people who go to other parties don't stay there in their voting patterns, as well as preference flows are likely to go back to the coalition. So I think there's, in a sense, bad news for both major parties, which is that there was a swing away from the coalition, but that swing didn't really go towards Labor. It was a little bit of a swing towards Labor, but more so towards the non-Greens, non-Labor parties.
Let's just take a quick break for a moment and we'll be back in a minute.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hi, I'm Sharon Bessel. Policy Forum Pod is the podcast for those who want to dig a little deeper into the policy challenges facing Australia and its region. Each week, we bring together expert analysis to tackle the big issues facing our region and to propose policy solutions. It's insightful, it's positive, and it's always fun. Policy Forum Pod is out every Friday. You can find it on iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you get your pods. Or find us at policyforum.net/podcasts.
Welcome back. As we go, the Australian has a news poll out today, and it's showing really for the first time that voters are more inclined to value action to reduce emissions than they are worried about higher power prices. Now, that may be a temporary thing. Yep. It may be a function of the scale and severity of this summer of bushfires and drought and so forth. But it is quite significant that that shift has happened. So this does dovetail quite well with your research as well.
Yeah, so we also looked at support for coal mines. So one of the questions which fortuitously had been asked in June was whether you support a new coal mines. And it was slightly less than majority support in June, but, you know, roughly 50-50 split, but a very large decline in support for new coal mines over the June to January period. And one of the things which I was a little bit surprised by was that the size of that change was greater for the coalition. So as you can imagine, we had voting patterns as of June, so this wasn't changes in voting also moving with changes in support for coal mines. This is fixing people at what they who they voted for the last election. Now, not many Greens voters supported new coal mines, and even fewer did in January, but that's not really that meaningful. But you went from around about three quarters to just a little over a half of coalition voters supporting new coal mines. And I think that's a big change. This isn't kind of the Canberra bubble, the Twitterati. This is people who did vote for the coalition in May, who said they would vote for the coalition in October, still changing their views on coal mines. And I think that's a big change.
And was that because climate change suddenly got real?
Yeah. So one of the other findings was that a bit of a surprise was there wasn't that big of an increase in people who thought climate change was an issue, kind of like an abstract concept. Like we say, is climate change an issue? You kind of, yeah, I guess it is. But what we found when we had quite a long-term perspective back to 2008 is a very large increase in people who thought it was a threat to them. So rather than being kind of an abstract climate change affecting people in poor countries, or I don't have a beachfront mansion. I'm not that worried about sea level rising, or yeah, just a little bit warmer. Okay, fine. Just turn the air conditioning up. This is something which the biggest change was people thought it was a threat to them, and I guess smoke rolling in to Sydney or Canberra or Melbourne is something very visceral, something very salient to people. Whereas kind of sea level rises over a 100-year period that's a problem, but
yeah, okay, you can't see it.
Yeah, you can't see it. You can see the smoke.
It.
Yep. And I think whether that becomes whether that's stable or not is a real question. Whether people think that it will still stay a threat to them is a question.
Exactly. The salience of this issue over the long run is clearly the sort of $60 million question in this whole issue. Given your experience with the ANU poll over many years, looking at trends, you know, is this issue analogous to any others in the past?
Yeah, no, that's a really good question. So last time we asked about the environment, it was during the just after the election of the Rudd government, and so it was quite a salient issue. And we did see, even though we didn't have longitudinal data then, we could see a spike in the proportion of people who thought the environment was an issue. So we do see, I guess, trends in issue salience, but I haven't seen as large a change in, I guess, policy attitudes towards particular policy questions over such a short period of time. And with a very consistently ask questions. So obviously you can ask questions in different ways and then people's attitudes change. But the change over a short period of time in a consistently asked question on a major policy issue, I haven't seen as large a shift as we saw with some of the questions which we asked on ANU poll. But yeah, look, I think that the extent to which people's views return to a baseline is obviously something which the government's going to be really focused on, and they're going to be making a lot of effort to kind of reverse that trend. I guess my understanding of the literature is that there are shifts when you look at people who are directly exposed to things like terrorism or natural disasters, but we don't really have good evidence around shifts which are national, which are in response to such a national, a crisis which has such a national effect. So Hurricane Katrina, for example, had a very large effect on views of George W. Bush, but really only physically affected a small proportion of the American population. 9/11 obviously had very large effects on a large proportion of the population, but that was still quite geographically concentrated. So this, I guess, gives us a chance to look at what about something which has had direct effects on, you know, about 15% or so of the population, and indirect effects on 3/4 of the population.
I think this is fascinating in the sense that, you know, if you're on the beach at Mallacoota, that you're never going to forget that. Yeah. That's going to be a searing moment in your life. But if you spent, you know, sort of 2 months stuck inside your house in Canberra, that's probably going to also be a sort of big kind of change. And I think it's really kind of interesting that you've noticed this change in the attitudes of women. And I wonder you know, how much of that is actually related to the fact that we're now talking about this issue in public health terms?
Yeah, so I think there's a couple of potential explanations for the gender differences in that swing. One is, just a general finding of females having greater social networks, and given that we're asking about not only concern about you but also concern about your network, that it's not surprising then that females not only report a higher rate of exposure, but also that the effects on females are likely to be greater. And that question around kind of the public health impacts is another really interesting one, which is we don't actually know what some of the public health impacts are likely to have been. And my guess is that as we find out more about some of those public health impacts, that's going to keep reinforcing the salience of the issue. So this isn't something which has had a short-term effect, or which the effects are kind of knowable in the short term, and then it's kind of forgotten about. My guess is we're going to get increasing data, increasing news about what the effects on the environment were, what the effects on wildlife was, what the public health effects were, and that's going to keep bringing the issue front of mind for potential voters. And the government's job, I guess, is to get it out of people's mind, and the opposition's job is to keep, not necessarily reinforcing the fear and anxiety, but to when the issue is not being physically experienced, to still keep people's lived experience in front of mind in how they and given that the likely given the observed impact on attitudes and beliefs in particular policy positions.
Is there a problem in some of this debate that the wrong question gets asked? You know, if people in, I'm not talking about necessarily your survey, but if people are being asked the question that the coalition would sort of like them to be asked, which is, you know, do you blame the bushfires on climate change or some such direct question like that, you're going to get a low number of people, because anyone who thinks about it with any depth is not going to blame the actual fire on climate change. But if you have a more nuanced question around the severity of fires, the propensity of fires, the build-up from sustained drought of fuel load on the ground, heat waves, it's a much more nuanced question. And the tendency, you know, the trend line of vulnerability is very much a function of a warming climate.
Yep. Yeah, and no, I think that's a really good, I guess, warning for automatically kind of taking these polls as face value, including ours, which was one of the reasons why we made sure we had consistent questions through time, so then we can at least look at consistent trends. But we also did try a few kind of wording experiments to kind of see how people responded to these to different framing. And one of the things I was surprised about is that there's a push, at, I guess, from first principles, a justified push to move away from discussions of global warming to global heating. And that kind of, you think, well, from first principles, that sounds more salient and is going to make people more likely to see that as an issue. We found the opposite. So when you frame things as global heating, there was a decrease in the proportion of people who thought it was an issue or a threat to them.
Do you think that's just because they don't know what global heating
exactly,
is?
Exactly. Yes. Yeah. So I think what that comes back to is that real challenge of asking about things which people are familiar with, and therefore giving them a framework which they can answer questions with, as opposed to asking questions in a way which reflect the changing science. And I think that's the challenge which you're talking about, which is that we do want to ask people about kind of the nuance of the debate. So things like emissions related to electricity as opposed to transport, as opposed to
agriculture.
And that's a real complex issue. And it's hard to gauge people's views on that without kind of priming them to answer in a certain way. So I think
which you don't want to do out there. Yeah.
No, that's generally undesirable.
Yes.
Yeah. But yeah, that is a real problem. Well, that's been really fascinating. Just quickly before we go, it also that your research showed up some interesting numbers on sort of trust. And I'm thinking about trust of firefighting authorities, for example, governments. Yep. You know, what tell us a bit about that.
Yeah, so my assumption going into the poll was that there'd be a decline in trust in the apparatus of government and a very strong – we asked about confidence, not trust, but very strong confidence towards those people who are on the ground. And the second effect held, whereas the first was a little bit more complicated. So I had thought that state and territory governments, the public service, would be caught up in this kind of crisis of confidence. But that's not what we found. We found a big decrease in confidence in the federal government, no change, no statistical
we'll
change
call that
in
the Hawaii effect.
Yeah, so exactly. So this was not about kind of the apparatus of government. I think the public saw that the public service was kind of doing what they should be doing. The state and territories governments were kind of doing what they should be doing. The police doing what they should be doing. So no real change in views towards that part of government, but a big decline in confidence in the federal government. And I think that's the challenge for, I guess, the coalition is that this isn't a crisis which we're all kind of in this together from a public policy perspective. It's a very much targeted towards A, Scott Morrison, and then B, the coalition. And I think that's the question, once again, comes back to whether that's going to stick or not.
It's a really fascinating question because, of course, the Prime Minister has announced this Royal Commission, which is going to be looking very specifically at the kind of firefighting effort and those issues of
coordination.
Coordination, adaptation, hazard reduction, those kinds of things. But also the federal power to intervene effectively in these, to declare a national state of emergency or whatever. And, you know, that's interesting in itself because this is a prime minister effectively looking for a mechanism to be able to regard something as an emergency, which when it was happening, he did not regard as a sufficiently big emergency to even stay in the country.
Yep.
And I don't think that will be lost on a lot of voters.
No, and I think the data suggests at least that it's going to be very hard for the government to shift blame on this issue. Confidence in the states and territories have remained pretty consistent. Right. The Rural Fire Service, I think 93%, close to 100% of people had confidence in the Rural Fire Service, and even the public service had pretty consistent levels of confidence. So I think it's not likely, a blame shifting approach is not likely to work. And I mean, I'm not a political advisor, but I think what is more likely to work is a recognition and then a policy response which reflects the views which are picked up in not only our data but also in other data, which is, as you said, that shift in news poll.
Well, historically, when leaders lose trust and have big collapses in their trust numbers, have they actually been able to gain them back?
Yeah. So, well, one of the interesting things is that this kind of takes us back, the confidence in the federal government kind of takes us back not too dissimilar to what it was prior to the election. And that loss in confidence was not from policy, that was from internal ructions. So when we looked at the time series in confidence, it's not like the federal government's always had this level of low confidence. But the previous lows were due to kind of internal, either when it was with Labor or when it was with Abbott and Turnbull or when it was with kind of Turnbull and Morrison. So the question is whether it's not as easy to move on from a kind of external crisis which is tied to the current PM if the PM doesn't change, as opposed to kind of internal debates and then a new leader and then a fresh start. So I think while there has been rebounding in confidence in previous data, that's been under a slightly different scenario, which is kind of self-inflicted internal, and the question is whether you can do the same.
A political dimension versus a public policy.
Exactly,
dimension.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. And because the public policy is so tied to Scott Morrison with a lump of coal. I mean, this is not something which didn't fit into a pre-existing narrative. And I think that's what makes it a little bit more difficult. Is this isn't something which, like coronavirus, which had no, there was nothing.
There's no backstory.
There's no backstory, exactly. No. So there's a chance to start afresh, even if Morrison was on the back foot or didn't kind of respond in the way which he otherwise might have wanted to, at least that didn't feed into a narrative and he had a chance to regain. Whereas I think it's hard to maneuver when it's so tied to why Morrison got the job in the first place and the positions which he took to the election.
Yeah, really fascinating stuff. Nick, thanks for coming in and talking about it. Thanks, Maria, once again for being here for this second serve or Democracy Sausage Extra or whatever we're calling it. And we'll look forward to seeing you and talking to you again soon.
Will there be onions?
Raw onions.
On the bottom or on the top?
Well, we have to eat them raw.
<That's>
on the top.
Bye for now.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.